TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Robert Fisk on the War on Iraq. This is a special rebroadcast of a recording I made in 2002. Robert Fisk, the award-winning war correspondent and dean of Middle East journalists, died in Dublin on October 30th. He was only 74. Robert Fisk won more British journalism awards than any of his peers, including British Foreign Reporter of the Year 7 times and the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism in 2002. The New York Times described him as probably the most famous foreign correspondent in Britain, and that in spite of his principle of speaking truth to power. Fisk was born in England, but took on dual Irish citizenship and did much of his intriguing and scholarly and history-based writing of books in Ireland, such as The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East, and Pity the Nation, Lebanon at War. However, Robert Fisk's real home since 1979 was in Beirut, Lebanon. He learned Arabic and worked from there, first for the Times of London and then for the London Independent, for over 4 decades. He had the courage to stay in Beirut during its years of civil wars and the foreign interventions by U.S., U.N., Syrian, and Israeli forces. In 1989, Fisk quit the Times of London, disillusioned by what he called an increasingly tame, pro-Tory, pro-Israeli paper, shorn of all editorial independence under owner Rupert Murdoch. Fisk reported on the massacres in the Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, following Israel's invasion of Lebanon, to the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and Syria, without sparing responsibility of the United States and his native Britain for so much of the carnage. Fisk became one of very few Western foreign correspondents to interview Osama bin Laden in the 1990s, and you will hear him describe that experience in the upcoming program. Here's a part of my 2002 introduction to Robert Fisk on the War on Iraq. In this talk, recorded in November 2002, he spoke about the hidden reasons of the Bush administration for going to war against Iraq, the connections of 9/11 to future wars, about the aftermath of Afghanistan, and about his meeting with Osama bin Laden. Here is Robert Fisk, recorded at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley in November 2002.
Ladies and gentlemen, September the 11th, 2001, did not change the world. Over and over, after September the 11th, this has become one of the outstanding, dangerous lies that we journalists have been propagating. September the 11th may give President George W. Bush an excuse to change the world, but that should be exposed for what it is, a manipulation of grief and fear in order to start a war that has nothing to do with the international crimes against humanity which took place in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania just over a year ago. A war against a country led indeed by a monster, but a country which has absolutely nothing to do with those atrocities. On September the 12th this year, I went along to the UN General Assembly to have a look at Mr. Bush. And when I saw him say, "The United States is not against the people of Iraq," I was very frightened, because before President George Bush Sr. bombed Iraq in 1991, he said that the United States is not against the people of Iraq. And before his son bombed Afghanistan last year, he said the United States is not against the people of Afghanistan. Normally now that means I better get my flak jacket out of the attic. But I also felt when I saw him that the United States was about to rewrite the history of the Middle East, a region which is white hot with anger at the United States. I think America wants to reshape the Middle East. It will, I suspect, be the most frightening attempt to change the map of the Middle East since Britain and France, victors over the Ottoman Empire, divided up the spoils of the 1914-18 war. I heard Mr. Bush's increasingly violent demands for an attack on Iraq and regime change elsewhere in the region. And be sure, if that war starts, our television broadcasters will use their familiar strapline, War on Terror. In the days and weeks that followed September the 11th, 2001, I did become increasingly disturbed by the vapid, hopeless, gutless, unchallenging journalism which passed for coverage in the Western media. The terrifying events The terrifying events of September the 11th were mutated into a movie, America at War, War on Terrorism, War on Terror. Often, these titles would appear in a kind of laminated gold typeface at the bottom left-hand corner of the screen, the kind that once appeared on biblical epics, you know, Ben-Hur with Charlton Heston. And each newscast would be introduced with an orchestral theme, a TV jingle to summon you back to the next episode of the serial. I felt that this obscured realities, just as I also felt that it dishonored the dead. My talk to you tonight is about the dangers now posed for journalism itself, the facile, unquestioning acceptance of authority, and of the trite and bland and deeply misleading government statements, which are parroted and then blended into titles and headlines. From the very start, I predicted in The Independent that this was not a war on terror, but a war against America's enemies, and most probably Israel's enemies too, which is what it is turning out to be. Yet we went along, indeed we still go along, against all the evidence, in calling this a war on terror. A war for democracy, a war against evil. Newsweek, this year, actually carried a front cover headline which read, "The Evil One." Not content with allowing governments to become TV headline writers, journalists are now using biblical authority for their stories. We, the West, democracy, the forces of good, we were the ones that suffered. And last September 11th, we were reminded to suffer again. But when the anniversary of the bombardment of Afghanistan fell due, did we carry long and moving accounts of the thousands of innocent Afghans killed by our bombs? Did we hell? But let me first ask you one question. When did we first hear of the Iraqi dimension of September the 11th? A dimension that factually has no substantial connection with the slaughter just over a year ago. Did anyone say back then, in the days and weeks immediately following these crimes against humanity, did anyone say back then that Iraq would be in the firing line? Where exactly did the slippage come? At what point did Osama bin Laden fade away to be replaced by Saddam Hussein? Our journalists, who should have picked this up at once, were silent. Far from doing their job, alerting readers and viewers to this astonishing transition in US policy, they went along with it. The New York Times and the Washington Post suddenly began to run long stories on the supposed intelligence links between Iraq and bin Laden. 8 stories in 1 week, I recall, each sourced to administration officials, intelligence officials, and diplomats, all of them, of course, anonymous. On one day, 2 weeks ago, I noticed that 7 important news stories contained the same words at the end of the first paragraph, comma, officials say. Watch in the next few days, you can look at the New York Times this morning, it's there too, how many stories in the first paragraph are sourced to, comma, officials say. I often think we should have a newspaper called Official Say. So today, while we're prepared to discuss the wisdom of starting yet another war in the Middle East, there is, after all, a perfectly bloody enough conflict already going on there, we remain quiescent. We do not want to investigate just how target Kabul became target Baghdad, and in the coming days perhaps target Damascus or target Beirut or even since the RAND Corporation's pro-Israeli lecturer referred to the kingdom as the kernel of evil, target Riyadh. Even when our own dear Prime Minister, Tony Blair, returns from the United States, telling us that there must be a blood price that has to be paid in the event of war, not a single journalist points out that this would be a blood price principally paid by the Iraqis, not by us, or by soldiers, young men from Manchester or Stockport, not by the likes of Mr. Blair. Blood, by the way, the word blood is becoming an increasing part of our discourse. Richard Armitage, Deputy Secretary of State, announced 2 months ago that the Lebanese Hezbollah may be the A-team of terrorism, Al-Qaeda presumably being relegated to the third division. Armitage said that the Hezbollah owed America a blood debt. Here, yet again, we're on the move. First, the heart of darkness beaten a man with a beard who had a propensity to live in Afghan caves. Then he transmogrified into a resident of Baghdad with a liking for chemical weapons and supposedly developing nuclear bombs. And now, out of the blue, it's Beirut we should be targeting. Armitage's blood debt was presumably a reference to the 241 American Marines killed by a suicide bomber at the US Marine base in Beirut in October 1983, but he didn't say so. Very few reporters have tried to winkle out what all this means. To its great credit, I should say that The Nation magazine in New York has published a first-class article detailing the number of US administration officials who have previously worked for pro-Israeli lobby groups in Washington. This at least might explain why the Bush administration now appears set to redraw the map of the Middle East along lines which Israel itself can only dream of. No mention of all this, of course, in the mainstream television media. Yet still our blindness goes on. Immediately after the 1991 Gulf War, once it was clear that the awful Saddam would remain in power, the US government suddenly stopped making any reference to the Iraqi president. I remember how Colin Powell told a press conference in northern Kurdish Iraq, which I had the pleasure to be present. I remember how he kept talking about Iraqi officials, but made no mention of the Hitler of Baghdad. So I asked him, what had happened to the Saddam factor? Why no more references to the man who had been bestialized, and not without good reason, a few weeks before? And Powell just shrugged his shoulders and went on talking about officials. Having failed to destroy him, Saddam had been turned into a non-person, to be recreated, of course, 11 years later when we wanted to go to war again. In just such a way, Osama bin Laden was airbrushed out of the picture. For 3 months, no US officials, certainly not the president, even mentioned him. Now, of course, to the embarrassment, I assume, of the White House, Mr. bin Laden has himself brought himself back into the frame with the audio tape. Anyway, if necessary, we can disinter him in the months to come if we need him. The language of journalism has, as usual, fallen into step with government. Note how almost every journalistic reference to Al-Qaeda now talks about how US forces in Afghanistan are mopping up, wait for it, Al-Qaeda remnants. The word remnants began to be used at US press briefings in Afghanistan and has now effortlessly and without any self-questioning entered the journalistic lexicon. We're always closing in on, hunting down, chasing, liquidating, cornering these elusive remnants. True, when US forces tried to ambush them at Shai Kot early this year, the remnants turned out to be of around brigade strength. And true, the attempted assassination of Hamid Karzai and the car bomb in Kabul that killed 26 people on the same day suggests there are rather more remnants than we bargained for. But no matter, we've now lined up Baghdad in our sights. Many of you must have remembered the New York Times story of October 10th this year. The White House is developing a detailed plan modeled on the post-war occupation of Japan to install an American-led military government in Iraq if the United States topples Saddam Hussein, senior administration officials say. The plan also calls for war crime trials of Iraqi leaders. General Tommy R. Franks, commander of US forces, Persian Gulf, would play the role of General Douglas MacArthur. Quite a role. Well, the problem, of course, with this is that there is no emperor of Iraq. The problem for General Tommy Franks, if he really does turn up in Baghdad to play the role of General MacArthur, is that the one unifying sovereign symbol that held Japan together amid the ashes of nuclear defeat in 1945 was the Emperor Hirohito, mysteriously absolved of all responsibility for Japan's atrocities in the Second World War. His military underlings went to the gallows on his behalf. But in Iraq, the emperor is called Saddam Hussein. And if we're to believe officials say, the Caliph of Tikrit will be in the dock along with the rest of Iraq's war criminals. General Franks will have to combine the role of emperor and colonial governor, which is how America's imperial adventure could come unstuck. What if the mosques defy American occupation? What if the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north set up their own secret administrations? Will the United States arrest all the imams who preach against America's hegemony? Immediately after the 1991 Gulf War, and this we tend to forget, so do I, because I went to this conference pretty exhausted after the war, but immediately after the 1991 war, a large group of Iraqi opposition figures met in Beirut to plan for a new Iraq. Sound familiar? Fondly, of course, and vainly imagining that Saddam would be gone within weeks. But within 24 hours, the opposition Iraqis, including the most secular and liberal of Iraqi movements, was announcing that it would not allow foreign troops, I quote, to contaminate the sacred banks of the Tigris and Euphrates River. At this point, of course, the Americans lost all interest in this manifestation of Iraq's opposition to Saddam Hussein. Now, in 1991, US troops occupied only a small part of southern Iraq. Does the Bush administration think things will be any better if they occupy all of Iraq?
You're listening to an archival speech by war correspondent Robert Fisk from November 2002. He had come to the US to support the resistance to war on Iraq. However, 4 months later, the US began the invasion. Robert Fisk, one of the most famous foreign correspondents of this time, died on October 30th, 2020 in Dublin. Here are his comments on Afghanistan, made in November 2002.
Afghanistan, and we should remember now the Iraqis are being told you can have democracy. Look at the great success we've made of Afghanistan. Afghanistan is descending deeper into anarchy. I was there 3 months ago. It is impossible to travel by night on the roads. The drug barons are back in control. Read the UN's warnings about the massive new narcotics traffic that is due to restart when this year's poppy crop is in. And we can't even bother to investigate the mass graves of northern Afghanistan, in which our war criminal allies buried well over 1,000 of their Taliban enemies, asphyxiated in container wagons. I was crossing the Atlantic on September the 11th, my 2001. My plane took off from Belgium just after the first reports of the attack on the World Trade Center and turned round off the coast of Ireland once the US closed its airspace. So I filed my first column to The Independent, my own paper, from my airline seat on the plane's satellite phone, without notes, dictating sentences out of my head to a copy taker, the old style copy taker with a typewriter or a laptop in Manchester, England. And I wrote that there would be an attempt in the coming days to avoid asking the why question. I wrote about the history of deceit and lies in the Middle East, the growing Arab anger at the deaths of thousands of Iraqi children under UN sanctions, and the continued occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. I suggested that bin Laden may well have been responsible. I wrote that thousands of Muslims may soon die in Afghanistan and elsewhere as a result of the outrages in New York and Washington. Emails poured into The Independent, most of them in support of the article, many demanding my resignation. The attacks on America were caused by, quote, hate itself of precisely the obsessive and dehumanizing kind that Fisk and bin Laden have been spreading, said one. According to the same message from Professor Judea Pearl of UCLA, I was drooling venom and a professional hate peddler. Another missive, signed Ellen Popper, announced that I was in cahoots with the arch-terrorist bin Laden. Mark Guan labeled me a total nutcase. I was psychotic, according to Lillian Barry Weiss. Brandon Heller of San Diego informed me that you are actually supporting evil itself. There's only 750 words. On an Irish radio show, a Harvard professor, whom I shall not name, was Alan Dershowitz, of course. announced that I was a liar, a dangerous man, and that anti-Americanism, of which I was obviously guilty, was the same as anti-Semitism. The show's presenter pulled the plug on the good professor, but I got the point. Not only was it wicked to suggest that someone, however perverted in mind, however twisted in logic, might have felt he had reasons to commit this mass slaughter, it was even more appalling to suggest what these reasons might be. To criticize the United States, or to be anti-American, whatever that is, was to be a Jew-hater, a racist, a Nazi. Merely to suggest that Washington's policies in the Middle East, its unconditional support for Israel, its support for Arab dictators, its approval of UN sanctions that cost the lives of so many children in Iraq, might in some perverted way lie behind the venomous attacks on September the 11th was an act of evil in itself. Oddly, the fact that the mass murderers were all Arabs and Muslims, and claimed to be Muslims, the fact that most of them came from Saudi Arabia was not regarded as a problem by reporters or readers or Harvard professors. This fell into the where and what slot. The sin was to connect the Arabs with the lands they came from, to ask the why question. When the cops turn up at the scene of any crime, here, for example, well, not here, let's say somewhere else in San Francisco, the first thing the cops do at the scene of a crime is look for a motive. Even on TV they do that. But when the crime scene is on a vast and terrifying scale in New York and Washington, the one thing we are not allowed to do is look for a motive. Isn't that strange? The killers were evil. They hated democracy, even though most of them wouldn't know what democracy was if it got into bed with them. Now, I say all this because I do have a personal, particular interest in Osama bin Laden. Back in 1997, I met him, and not for the first time. I had interviewed him in Sudan in 1994, then in Afghanistan in 1996, then again the following year. That last night when we met, I was driven by one of his armed followers hundreds of miles across the mountains of Afghanistan, high up the rugged, towering Kabul Gorge. The clouds were below us, waterfalls of ice clinging to the rock above our Toyota. At one point, the gunman who was driving turned to me and said, "Toyota is good for holy war." Bin Laden would not have made a joke like that. After hours of sliding and slipping on the scree above sheer precipices, we reached a plateau of stones and an air raid shelter 25 feet high and 25 feet wide, cut into the living rock of the mountainside by Bin Laden's construction teams at the height of the war between the Afghans and the Russians. A war in which Bin Laden fought with great courage, on our side, of course, being wounded 6 times, fighting for the West, though he claimed that wasn't the case. Indeed, most of the camps, including the one in which I spent that night in 1997, were later bombed with great precision by the United States in October, November last year. Indeed, the American military thought that we should praise this precision. The only thing they didn't point out, of course, is that all these camps were built by the CIA. Not difficult to find them on a map. In any event, that last night in 1997, I waited in a tent along with several of Bin Laden's armed followers. They weren't called Al-Qaeda then. A paraffin lamp sputtered in the corner. Then Bin Laden himself came in, lithe as a cat, but with a slight infirmity, I thought, in one of his feet. A white dish dash, red kufir, very cheap plastic sandals on bare feet. I was carrying over my shoulder a school satchel, which I use in rough countries, to carry my passport and other documents. But Bin Laden saw some Arabic language newspapers in the bag and seized upon them. Turning to study them in the corner of the tent in silence for all of 20 minutes. He didn't even know that the Iranian foreign minister had just visited Saudi Arabia, his own country. And I sat there with his men, all of us ignored by Bin Laden, and thought how isolated he appeared to be. Didn't he have a radio? Didn't he have a television? When he spoke, it was with a determination, a chilling self-conviction, which I had not seen before. I still have my notes of that meeting, of course, and what he said is even more sinister in retrospect. "Mr. Robert," he said, "we fought and beat the Russian army in Afghanistan. We won our battle over the Russians from this very mountain upon which you are now sitting. And that battle destroyed the Soviet Union." Bit of an exaggeration, but quite a lot of truth in that. From time to time, very disconcertingly for a journalist, Bin Laden would clean his teeth during my questions with a piece of wood, a piece of mishwak wood. Then he went on, "Mr. Robert, I pray to God that he will permit us to turn the United States into a shadow of itself." Ladies and gentlemen, I couldn't fail to remember those words when I saw those terrible images of New York's World Trade Center disappearing into two almost biblical columns of smoke. And New York, I realized then, was now a shadow of itself. Just one word, and I felt deeply disturbed. But Bin Laden's power in the Middle East, comes from what he says rather than what he does. I don't think he climbs to the top of a mountain and pulls out a mobile phone and says, "Plan B." Hollywood might make him do that, even the State Department, but I don't think that's how it works. I fear, however, that his awful power and influence comes more from his words. Many times I have listened to them, personally present, his armed followers hanging upon those words as if he was a messiah or a Mahdi. He would demand that the American forces leave the Middle East, leave what he called, quote, "the land of the two holy places," Saudi Arabia, Mecca and Medina. He demanded the end of what he called the corrupt regimes which are supported by the West, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, Egypt, Jordan, you know, which torture their own people. He demanded an end to Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. He demanded an end to the sanctions which have killed so many Iraqi children. Whether or not he really felt that strongly, that is what he said. And his words do have a special resonance in an Arab world which has for decades felt humiliated by the West, especially by America, a world which many of its millions believe has indeed been corrupted and damaged almost beyond repair by the culture and armed might and politics of the West. Without those feelings of despair and humiliation and fury, Bin Laden would truly be a voice in the wilderness, ignored, derided, perhaps freighted to a hospital for the insane. But to many Arabs, and this is the point, to many Arabs who were appalled for both moral and religious reasons by the staggering massacres in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania, Bin Laden does not sound insane, which is why his voice is listened to so scrupulously by so many millions of Arabs across the Middle East.
That was the first part of an hour-long speech by Robert Fisk on the war on Iraq that he gave in Berkeley in 2002. The award-winning war correspondent and dean of Middle East journalists died in Dublin on October 30th. He was only 74. I never missed a chance to produce a radio program with him when he came to the Bay Area. And you can find them all for free on my website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gladden. Thank you for listening.